The Teaching of the Master by Brother L.G. Sargent. Part 3, Chapter 8, The Way of Non-Resistance. Matthew chapter 5, verse 38 to 42. Ye have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you, resist not evil. But whosoever smiteth thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if any man would go to law with thee, and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. And whosoever shall compel thee to go 1 mile, go with him twain. Give to him that asketh thee, and from him that would borrow of thee, turn not away. When Jesus turns from the sanctity of God to the disciples' relation to other men, it is immediately clear that he is picturing them as sojourners in an alien world. They will be subject to oppression, injustice, contumely. These are not principles of God's law or of the kingdom which the meek are to inherit. They belong to the time of subjection before the inheritance is entered. But that is the time when men show whether they are in God's covenant, and therefore whether the kingdom is theirs. If they are, then the principle which governs all their actions is, resist not evil. Again, it is literally the evil, and it cannot mean the devil either of tradition or of truth, for whatever he is to be resisted. The Revised Version renders him that is evil, the violent and oppressive man. But one commentator says, we need not ask as to the gender of to ponero. Just as in chapter 5, verse 37, it meant the evil and sinful element in life, regarded from the abstract point of view, so here it is the same element contemplated as in action through an individual. The question is, what are we to do? Not with the evil in ourselves, but with the evil shown by others towards us. Say not, I will do so to him as he hath done to me. I will render to the man according to his work. The law did not justify personal vengeance. Retribution was judicial. The Pharisees interpreted eye for eye, tooth for tooth, not as literally requiring mutilation for injury, but as technical legal terms which enjoined that compensation should be strictly commensurate with the injury done. So far as the time of Christ is concerned, we may say that the lex talionis was not in practice applied literally, and was not interpreted literally in the prevailing view. What exactly was the original intention of the law is a more difficult question. In the Code of Hammurabi, the law, eye for eye, was applied with a rigidity which led to remarkable consequences. If a builder erected a house so badly that it fell down, causing the death of the owner in the ruins, the builder's own life was forfeit. But if it was the owner's son or daughter who perished, not the builder, but his own son or daughter must pay the penalty. Such a perversion of justice could only be based on an entirely different conception of human life from that in the law of Moses. The son or daughter is viewed not so much as an individual, each with a life which is inviolable by man's hand, but rather as part of the property or rights of their father. In the law of Moses, so far as relations between man and man are concerned, Life itself is the supreme value to be safeguarded by law. Life with all its attributes as the possession under God of each living soul. There seems even to be a deliberate allusion to the Babylonian law in Exodus 21 verse 31. Here the law lays down that where an ox has been known to gore in time past, the owner's life shall be forfeit if it causes the death of another person. And it is added, whether he have gored a son or a daughter, according to this judgment shall it be done unto him. So far as killing with intent is concerned, he that smiteth a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. No ransom is to be accepted for the life of a manslayer. But Dr. Hertz contended that this specific exception implies that money compensation was not excluded in other cases. The first statement of the law, eye for eye, in Exodus 21 verse 24, actually follows a provision for paying compensation to cover loss of time and cost of treatment in the case of a man who is confined to bed by injury, verses 18 and 19. Other contexts also present difficulties of a literal interpretation, particularly that of Deuteronomy 19 verse 21, where it occurs in the law of plotting witnesses. In whatever way these clauses were to be applied, they established two legal principles. First, all were equal before the law. The tooth of the poor man was of the same value as the tooth of the princeling. The law declared his rights as a man of the seed of Abraham, independent of rank or wealth. Secondly, the law established measure for measure. Retribution, whatever its form, must be neither more nor less than the offence, neither exacting double in the spirit of vengeance, nor allowing the powerful to escape with the wrong half redressed. This principle of measure for measure is the essence of natural justice, and the only equitable basis on which law can be administered in the state. Yet it is precisely this which Jesus says is not open to his disciples. They, of all people, are not to exact their dues or maintain their rights. And there could be no clearer contrast between legislation to be administered by the state and the principles of living for the pilgrims of Jesus. The state must maintain equity between man and man. Jesus lays down the motive of conduct from a disciple to other men. What these principles of living are, he illustrates by three instances. First comes the personal insult, which is often harder to bear sweetly than material injury. As in Lamentation 3, verse 31, the blow inflicts indignity rather than injury. A blow intended to knock a man down would be struck with the right fist, and therefore would land on the left side. Jesus would, in fact, seem to have the words of Jeremiah in mind, for the theme of the prophet in the context is the discipline of suffering when it is accepted as a yoke laid on a man's shoulders by the Lord. It is good that a man should hope and quietly wait for the salvation of the Lord. It is good for a man that he bear the yoke in his youth. Let him sit alone and keep silence because he hath laid it upon him. Let him give his cheek to him that smiteth him. Let him be filled full with reproach. For the Lord will not cast off for ever. So the servant of the Lord hid not his face from shame and spitting. His own fulfilment of that prophecy is the perfect example of the precept applied. The pain and shame inflicted by the servants of the high priest, or the soldiers of Pilate or Herod, the strain of the trial through a sleepless night and a morning of exhaustion. The scourging, the thorn wreath, the mockery of his royal claims, all these he bore without flinching in the silence of humility. But one incident saves us from too narrow an application of this saying. When in the inquiry before the high priest one of the officers struck him, Jesus did not literally turn the other cheek. With perfect calmness he called attention to the irregularity. If I have spoken evil, bear witness of the evil. But if well, why smitest thou me? He was not defending his own dignity. It was necessary for the very purpose for which he had surrendered himself to the power of men, that the illegality of the proceedings should be made clear. He died without fault. The blow had followed his refusal to answer questions before a prima facie case had been made out by witnesses, and it was one more evidence of the injustice of the trial. In the same spirit, Paul and Silas, not for their own sake, but for the sake of the gospel, insisted on the Philippian magistrates recognizing the illegality of their conduct. The next example is a submission to harsh legal exaction. The law mercifully protected the poor. If thou at all take thy neighbour's raiment to pledge, thou shalt deliver it unto him by that the sun goeth down. For it, that is his covering only, it is his raiment for his skin, wherein shall he sleep? And it shall come to pass, when he crieth unto thee, that I will hear, for I am gracious. But Jesus forbids his disciples to avail themselves of it. If a creditor demands the less costly undergarment, chiton, in pledge, the more valuable outer garment, himation, is to be surrendered too, even if it deprives the debtor of his covering for the night. Another example of putting the extreme case so as to enforce the lesson powerfully. The saying is illustrated from the opposite end by a story told of a rabbi who had suffered the loss of a cask of wine through the negligence of the coopers. He took their coats in order to reimburse himself, at which they complained to a distinguished teacher. "Give them back their coats," was the judgment. "Is that what you call dealing out justice?" asked the rabbi. "Yes," he said. "Walk in the way of good men, as Solomon commands." Proverbs 2, verse 5. He gave them their coats, but they complained. "We are poor people and have worked all day long and are hungry and have nothing." And the judge said, "Come, give them their wages." "Is that dealing justice?" asked the rabbi. "Yes," said he. "For Solomon continues, keep the paths of righteousness." Luke, in his account of the address Jesus gave after choosing the apostles, gives two similar sayings, but in a form which relates both of them to acts of violence. "Unto him that smiteth thee on the cheek, offer the other also, and from him that taketh away thy cloak, withhold not thy coat also." The omission of right before cheek removes the qualification which makes the smiting a mere flick of contempt. The mention of the cloak before the coat implies the surrender of the undergarment when the outer has been snatched away by a robber. These details are two of many which enforce the belief that Luke is recording a different address from Matthew. But the variation throws added light on the sayings and widens their scope. The third example in Matthew carries non-resistance into the disciples' relations with authority. The word for compel has an interesting history. Herodotus applies it to the Persian system of conveying official dispatches by couriers, both horses and men being relieved at the end of each day's journey. This is referred to in Esther chapter 8, verse 10, which the Revised Version renders, "He sent letters by posts on horseback, riding on swift steeds that were used in the king's service, bred of the stud." Royal couriers could impress into state service the common people and their possessions, and so by the 3rd century BC, the term had come to be used for requisitioning of services or property, pack animals or boats, for instance, especially for the transport of military baggage. The best illustration is an inscription of AD 49 in the gateway of the temple in the Great Oasis, in which Capito, prefect of Egypt, refers to exactions which had been made, and decrees that soldiers passing through the several districts are not to make any requisitions or to employ forced transport without the prefect's written authority. This indicates the abuse of authority from which subject peoples in the Roman Empire might suffer. In the Gospel record, Simon the Cyrenian is impressed into service by the Roman soldiers to carry the cross. And these are the only other New Testament occurrences of the word. Impressment was a mark of the humiliation of the people of God's kingdom at the hands of an alien power whom they called the lawless. The country was seething with unrest, and there were recurring outbreaks. The day was not far off when the Jews themselves would choose Barabbas, a bandit implicated in murders committed in the course of insurrection, rather than Jesus. It is in this atmosphere that Jesus commands submission to the powers that be, even when that means accepting a hated foreign rule, response to official demands, even when power is being abused by some minor representative of the state. A willing and generous response which does more than is asked. While the command's main aim is to purge strife and bitterness from the heart of the disciple, it shows by implication the attitude of Jesus to worldly authority. The wider lesson was drawn by Peter: submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether it be to the king as supreme, or unto governors, that with well-doing he may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men. Honour all men. Love the brotherhood. Fear God. Honour the king. So also Paul: let every soul be subject unto the higher powers. Render to all their dues, tribute to whom tribute is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honour to whom honour. The object which the Lord has in view in all these injunctions is to develop the character of the disciple into that of a citizen of the kingdom. But this presents a peculiar difficulty. If the disciple fulfills the command with the same object, his own self-development, then the motive becomes self-regarding and defeats its own end. The man who receives a blow in silence in order that he may be the more a saint is in grave danger of becoming a prig, and prigs certainly do not belong to the class the Lord calls blessed. The Christ-like man suffers the blow so that perchance he may win the giver of the blow, and it may be save a soul from death. It is then that love covers a multitude of sins. From the application, Jesus moves on to the principle, and in the next section he shows the place of love as the active power of the disciple's life, love which must by its very nature look outwards from itself. This difficulty confronts the disciple particularly in carrying out the saying which forms a climax to the present section. In Luke, as in previous instances, a rather different saying enjoins submission to high-handed action. Give to every man that asketh of thee, and of him that taketh away thy goods, ask them not again. But in Matthew the thought has moved through A, the response to insult, B, legal exaction, and C, official compulsion, to D, the point where a man is free to comply with or to refuse a simple request. The words are in no way new. The law had commanded, Thou shalt open thine hand wide unto thy brother, to thy poor and to thy needy in the land. Proverbs provides the germ of the parable of the importunate neighbour. Say not unto thy neighbour, Go and come again, and tomorrow I will give, when thou hast it by thee. One of the essential qualities of righteousness in the Old Testament is that a man shall be good of eye, which means that he shall be generous in his outlook, in contrast to the evil eye, which is the sign of the niggardly, grudging heart. But Jesus is surely no less concerned than the sages of old with the disposition which is manifested rather than with the act of giving. And the generous spirit can rest content with nothing less than the well-being of the recipient. For this reason, while the request for help cannot be refused, the gift may not always take the form which the giver asks. The question has often been asked, Am I to give money to a man who will probably spend it on drink at the nearest public house? The present writer's answer would be unhesitatingly no. To give that which corrupts the recipient is not to give, but to get. The return for it may be in self-righteousness at having literally fulfilled a command, or self-satisfaction at the emotional gluttony of giving, or it may be merely the taking of the easy way out of a difficulty. But it is not an act of love which moves outward to one in need. Yet if the Christ Spirit is there, the appeal will not fall on deaf ears. There are other ways of giving than in money, in food, for instance, or in time or service. They demand more of the giver, are more troublesome and inconvenient, so much so that they may not be practicable in every case at any moment. It may not always be possible to take a man who asks you for money in the street and pay for a meal for him at a suitable eating house. But it is at least an instance of what is meant by giving for the recipient's sake rather than for one's own. In each of these sayings, the Lord is painting in a phrase a mental picture which shows the principle in action. In the parallelism of this one saying, there are two scenes. In the first, a man turns towards the petitioner at his elbow. He listens in an attitude of attention which reflects a ready heart. He puts himself in the other man's place. In the other picture, the man turns away. His head is averted with chilling disinterest. And Jesus says, in effect, Which of those men are you? Yet Jesus himself balanced the claims made on him. Though all men sought him at Capernaum, he said, Let us go into the next towns, that I may preach there also. For therefore came I forth. He did not respond immediately when his mother and his brethren tried to speak to him. He refused a sign to the Pharisees when they asked for it. And he declined outright request for aid, which was made in the wrong spirit. Paul, in this, as in so many things, faithfully interpreted the Lord in word and deed, and it is to him that we owe an otherwise unrecorded saying which further illustrates the Lord's teaching. Ye yourselves know that these hands have ministered unto my necessities, and to them that were with me. In all things I gave you an example, how that so labouring ye ought to help the weak, and to remember the words of the Lord Jesus, how he himself said, It is more blessed to give than to receive. In writing to the Ephesians, he gives the example of the replacing of self-seeking by self-giving. Let him that stole steal no more, but rather let him labour, working with his hands the thing that is good, that he may have whereof to give to him that hath need. So the believer will do good, Revised Version, work that which is good, to all men, especially unto them who are of the household of faith. To do good and to communicate, forget not. Weymouth, do not forget to be kind and liberal. For with such sacrifice God is well pleased. The self can only grow through forgetting self. The kingdom can only be attained through seeking the salvation of others. And while love as the motive of non-resistance to others is not lacking in the Old Testament, see for instance Proverbs 25, verse 21 to 22, in the words of Jesus, the principle is expressed fully and finally.